This week on Unbox, I'm speaking with Simon Gunning, who is the CEO of the incredible charity Calm. That is the Campaign Against Living Miserably. They do so much for so many people across the country with their amazing helplines, as well as their outreach and their programs to support and uplift ultimately people who are struggling with mental health and well-being in this life.
Every suicide costs £1.68 million, so that's just shy of £15 billion a year. That's the cost of suicide deaths. Just go and talk to someone. What's the worst that can happen? Put your hand up. It's like jumping into a cold swimming pool. It's really, really awful for the first little bit. And then you kind of find, you're getting used to this now. This is actually all right.
They've saved thousands of lives. They look after people across the nation. And we're a massive fan of them. As many people will know, they were one of our headline partners at the Sidemen Charity Match 2022.
For every attempt, there's over 100 people affected.
Suicide is so pervasive today. I wanted to talk to Simon to get into all of that and to understand how, as an entrepreneur myself and for other entrepreneurs out there, how I can and we can together learn about this issue so we can support our staff, our friends, our families, and ourselves in mental health and well-being, which is so, so important. We're going to cover all of that today. I'm very excited. Let's get into it with Simon. Well, Simon, thank you so much for coming on Unboxed.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I wanted to start as the CEO of Calm, who has been on an incredible trajectory over the last few years, I'm sure since you took over and started running the business. I wanted to get straight into the topic of suicide, because I think, A, it's one of the most important issues that we as a culture and a society face, but you are really with Calm, and I heard you talk about this on a podcast, that, you know, you are there to support the team and their mission and the people out there raising money, but you're really on the front line of supporting people with this issue and supporting this whole nation with this issue. So can you talk to me about suicide and why, for you as the leader of this business and this charity, why it's such an important issue for us to address?
Because it's a public health emergency, and it's one that we voluntarily shy away from and hide ourselves from. The numbers are horrific, and there's a relatively small number, which is deaths. That's 6,500 people a year, 125 people a week. But that's quite a small number. When you get to the bigger numbers, so for every death, there's 25 attempts. And then for every attempt, there's over 100 people affected. So as you come out of this blast radius, you realise, in a way that's sort of relaxing, sort of reassuring, that this isn't some dark, dirty, weird thing hidden away. This is like a species-level behaviour. One in five of all of us will have suicidal ideation in our lives. It's not weird. It's a normal thing. And that's sort of temporarily relaxing. Then you go, oh, okay, so I can do something about it. And then you go, because then that's really terrifying, especially bearing in mind the fact that we don't want to talk about it. I've been doing this for 6 years, and I come up to that word, and there's something in my brain going, don't say it, don't say it, don't say it. It's horrible. But we have to say it. And we have to talk about it, and we have to get it out of the dark and into the light, because it doesn't like the light. It likes the dark. It likes the shame and the stigma. But the other way of looking at it is, why is it so important, is meet somebody who's been directly affected, meet somebody who's lost their kid or their parent or their loved one or their friend, and talk to them about that experience, and then deny that it's an important thing to want to deal with. Or then, because we're the Campaign Against Living Miserably, the countless numbers of people, so 6,500 times 125 people who are attempting every single year, that's living miserably, and they're us. They're not different people, they're us.
So to get to the root of that then, and, you know, why is there a culture in a lot of ways, and I see it myself, of overwhelming misery in this country? I think a lot of people are, from in my demographic, I'm not sure. Have you got kids?
Yeah, I've got two teenagers, yeah.
Teenagers, yeah. I mean, I'm 26 now, so I've kind of been young and grown up in this time of social media dominating everything and culture and society being, and I think, in a really challenging place for young people more than ever. There's so many pressures and challenges, cost of living, etc. But what do you think is really at the cause of why this has just become an exponential issue in recent years?
It's sort of like a handed down issue, but slightly differently from generation to generation. So if we go back to the group that's been the worst affected historically, that is men who would probably have been in their 40s, around 2008, when the crash happened. And that was, at that point, the fastest growing group. But drilling into that group, that suicide has followed that group through their lives. So when they were adolescents, teenagers, young adults, adults, middle age, suicide has been a part of their life. They've always been at the top. So why is that? So let's go back one and think about the generation before and what had happened. So world wars, rationing, the kind of the stoic reality of a world that had been smashed to pieces for the First and Second World Wars. I mean, there was a gap, obviously, but... You know,
not much,
and certainly not economically speaking, because in that gap you had the Wall Street crash and then you had all of the rest of it that came with that. So if you look at that generation, most of whom are dead now, but there was no language, there was no permission. I think about my dad, who was born just after the Second World War, and you know he grew up in Shepherd's Bush, and the place was bombed, and probably the bloke next door either didn't come back from the war or came back with bits missing, and you got on with stuff. And there was rationing, and that's then passed on to the next one and then passed on to the next one. But on those sort of different layers, what I think we're seeing is the passing of that baton of shame, but in a different environment. Because the thing that really rattles me is that whilst we can look at that group and we know that 3/4 of deaths are male, even though attempts are pretty much the same, and we can sort of kind of understand that they're the breadwinner, that man up, grow a pair, you can sort of see what's going on, even if maybe there's a little bit of guesswork in there, but there are cultural issues which have been handed down from the previous generation, which we can see. What's really frightening to me is that 16 to 24-year-olds are now the fastest-growing group in history. They've overtaken that older group. Yeah. So this is, we talk about this, well, it's always not always a mental health issue, let's not forget that.
What do you mean by that?
But it's not necessarily directed, completely connected to a mental health condition. It's often impetuous. It's often spontaneous. It's often, people refer to a permanent solution to temporary problems, which I think is perhaps borderline patronising, but it's often very much a spontaneous act of violence. We're not talking about a mental health emergency. We're talking about a public health emergency. When we look at kids and when we look at inside that 16 to 24-year-old group, females 10 to 21 are that subgroup that are growing at the very, very highest rate. So that's with what's called suicidality, a propensity to consider suicide as an option. Now, I think whilst we can look at that previous generation and think we understand why, I think we probably understand why 10 to 21-year-old females are finding life hard. Mm. Where are you going to live? What job are you going to get? And then we layer on the obvious body image comparisons, all of those, that sort of stuff that's affecting kids.
So you said that group of 10 to...
21 females, but that's kind of a group inside...
Within the 16 to 24.
16 to 24.
But if you were to map them against any other group, are they kind of the fastest?
Fastest.
Rising. Wow. Yeah. And do you see that, and do you measure that based on the calls and based on the data that you get? Like, how does that data come in?
It's Office of National Statistics. So
it
comes through the coroner's courts for deaths. But suicidality, a key indicator of suicidality is self-harm. Mm. And so we can see they're over-indexing very clearly onto those groups, self-harm in various forms.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about deaths there in suicidality. But everything that comes from that constitutes suicide statistics comes from the coroner's court.
And it's interesting you say about the 75% being male, right? So one thing that I read something recently which struck a chord, which is around that concept of shame, as you said, and that actually in men there's a greater propensity for shame being the driver of depression and also suicide. Shame around maybe income, status, relationships, all these factors. What are some of the things which you think drive that 75% in terms of that shame matrix, so to speak, and what are the reasons for that from your experience understanding?
What I've found really interesting, when I've haven't done anything like this in my life until 6 years ago when I started doing it, and you just come across fact after fact which blows your mind. One of the things that was amazing but sort of rung so true was that we run a helpline, which is staffed by paid and trained professional people. They're not volunteers, so that's, we're quite unusual, and we're very interventionist, so we'll put plans together for people, for people that want to talk on a or type to a human, and we've got a whole load of digital tools for people that don't. But what I found fascinating was that when very frequently men will call a helpline and they'll be talking, they'll present as being fine. Like, yeah, fine, everything's great. And it takes 10 minutes, 15 minutes before they'll start admitting that things aren't great. You've just run a helpline looking for help. But so deeply wired that we've got to present success. We've got to present affluence, professionalism. We've got to present... we have to be sexually attractive, you know, especially when you're talking to a woman, even if you, you know, do you know what I mean? That all this stuff is loaded so heavy, it's really hard to get down to the bottom, and the bottom is shame. That's the not fulfilling your personal ambition, not fulfilling the ambition that society tells you you should be going after. Never comparing ourselves to somebody who's doing worse than us, always comparing ourselves to somebody who's doing better. All of those things, but you're spot on. Shame is at the heart of so much that drives those male behaviours.
So it's interesting. I mean, one of the things coming into this that I'm personally, and obviously with this show, my whole driving ambition now is to learn from every single person that comes on, and ultimately as an entrepreneur and as somebody who is, I kind of hate that word, as somebody who is, you know, building in this modern world and is growing up in this time and is, you know, working with the Sidemen, everything else that we're doing, you know, I'm trying to drive a real intention in these conversations. And one of the things that I'm in awe of about everything that you do is around how you confront this head on. But something that I'm personally really interested in is how I can learn from you as to methods and strategies to help with myself, with the team that I look after, and we look after Arcade, and then also, you know, the fans and the people that we are ultimately interacting with on a constant basis. So what do you think are some of the kind of hidden things that are going on in the culture right now, or some of the, you know, maybe surprising elements to that I can take in terms of understanding the state of play for young people out there?
The first thing I would say is that there's a guy called Professor Rory O'Connor. He's a very, very clever and very, very nice man at University of Glasgow. He backs up stuff that we've taken on board a lot that came from the World Health Organization, which is that suicide is a highly preventable cause of death. Even though if you're over 14 and under 40, it's the thing that's most likely to kill you. But it's highly preventable through what they call low-cost interventions. And the main intervention that Rory O'Connor talks about is talking about it, is getting that word into society. And like I said before, I think perhaps a little bit pretentiously, that taking it out of the dark and into the light, because it doesn't like the light, it wilts in the light. How do you encourage different sorts of behaviours? Well, think about issues. And I think it's in your business, what you do is so interesting, because you can provide so many solutions for the three things we've identified that we want to confront. We want to help people who have a lack of self-worth, help people who have a lack of a feeling of being a part of something bigger than themselves, and then a sense of entrapment. So those are the three things: self-worth, sense of being a part of something bigger, and sense of entrapment. So when you're creating communities around content, when your listeners, your viewers, sorry, your audience are creating their content, and we see it in the stuff that we do with you. We definitely see it with stuff like Jingle Jam, you know, like this community of absolute vibrant, brilliant personalities that pull people with them and cement stuff that maybe is being dismantled in society. That sense of being a part of something bigger, sense of self-worth, sense of entrapment are removed. So those are the things. Get it out in the open and address those three key points.
So if I'm a young person out there and I'm sort of feeling trapped and I'm feeling like maybe I don't have self-worth, sorry, what are some of the sort of tangible things that you suggest people to look at doing, or that you found help the majority of people that you support?
When it comes to our helpline, that really is about putting plans together. When it comes to the kind of products that we create, that's events, clubs, communities, joining up with people that have a shared passion point is really important to us. So we exist deeply in culture, and that's been right from the start, when I started doing it, that bringing in football, music, comedy, rugby, cycling, art, all sorts of, through amazing people like yourselves, art with the Connor brothers, comedy with Ramesh Ranganathan and Susie Ruffle and Mark Watson and all those kind of brilliant people, sport with Declan Rice, and then working with you, culture is of such profound importance that you find your tribe with your cultural preferences. You know, you can identify somebody that likes the same bands as you, even if you like American girl punk bands from the late 90s. You can find your place in society when, I think probably what, as tribal animals, we have almost intentionally dismantled our tribes. Mm. We've distanced ourselves physically. We've also dismantled some of the deep sort of connectivity that we have through suspicion, competition, through the kind of shameful things that we were talking about before, that we don't have this connectivity as tribes. And that's a part of what I really want to try to put back.
Yeah, that's really interesting, that piece around tribes. And I guess the internet and the world of social and, I guess, connection globally has pros and cons. One is that there are so many more people to connect with, but on the other hand, people can feel more disconnected from the people closest to them and from physical connection. Yeah. Actually, physical connection, as you're saying, you guys are pioneering that in terms of, you know, you're showing up to, you know, making events happen, bringing people into physical spaces. As you say, yes, the internet exists and social media is a big part of everyone's lives, but actually bringing people together is really powerful, right? And actually such a key kind of part of it all. Going back to, I guess, COVID and the pandemic, I'm interested in how you, having been here for 6 years, pre and post that time, which obviously goes without saying, fundamentally shifted everything in so many ways. What was it like at that point for you? And I actually saw on a podcast, I think you said it didn't increase suicides, which I think people might find surprising. But what was that whole period like to navigate as a CEO of the leading suicide prevention business and charity, sorry, in the country?
It was awful.
I can imagine.
It was absolutely terrifying. Yeah, because all the money stopped. So we don't get any money from government, which means that we can do mad. We discovered that World Mental Health Day coincided, and we don't really go in for things like World Mental Health Day that much, but it coincided with World Toilet Day. So we did a campaign where we printed feeling shit onto huge toilet rolls, and you can't do that if you've got government money. You can't
take
pivot.
Risks in the
yeah,
same
you
way,
can't
yeah.
take risks. You can't pivot into things. You can't go after the government, which we do. We've just found that the money stopped because we're relying on people putting on gigs, putting on football matches.
What did that look like tangibly? I mean, in terms of, you know, money correlating to helpline, which I guess is from obviously the work we've done with you, the biggest cost.
Yeah.
What did that actually look like? In some kind of like overnight, what was it like? Literally just off a cliff.
So sort of like 1 week into lockdown, I looked at the bank, or somebody told me to look at the bank. We'd banked 10 quid in a day. It's unbelievable.
Versus what would have normal been?
60 grand, 80 grand. You know, like it just, the whole thing stopped. It just stopped. Everything stopped. And so I just had to pivot, horrible phrase, but I apologise for it. But that's what had to happen. Yeah. We had to have like an 8-point strategy plan that I did stomping around my kitchen. And it worked. And we came out of it and we ended up actually exceeding our initial target. Fortunately, we had, and we still have, a fair amount of money in the bank. I mean, they're small numbers. Charities don't operate on the kind of numbers that proper, you know, that commercial businesses do. And it's all public, so I have absolutely no issue talking about it. We should be around a £10 million a year revenue business, and we're around a £6 million revenue business. But we've got around £6 million in the bank, and that was sort of similar back then. What we should have done is we should have grown by now. So we should be much bigger. But lockdown knocked us. What it didn't knock us, though, was our reach, and that's what saved us. So in really leaning into culture, in leaning into the brands that supported us, that's a big part of our business is brand partnerships, and they supported us by getting us on, like literally Head and Shoulders put us into their above the line TV advertising, with Claudia Winkleman literally saying, if you're terrified, you can call Calm. And that just started to bring it back together. And then the momentum picked up and we had people doing absolutely nuts stuff. We had a guy running a marathon every day in his back garden. And his back garden was about the size of a rug, just going round and round and round and round and round for like 20 days. And I think what we'd done is, I think we'd got enough goodwill in the bank up to that point that when we sort of put out a bit of an emergency, people just rallied around us, and our brand partners would send us checks. It was just not physically, but you know what I mean. Yeah, yeah. It was just fantastic.
You can go to the bank to check them in.
You couldn't go anywhere. Yeah, those big comedy ones that you have to carry around. And it saved us. So that on the one side, the business was terrifying, and then it was just like life affirming that everybody would come together to save it, and we stayed on that course. As far as what it was that we were experiencing, we shifted our position to be here for you no matter what was our new position, because we figured people don't want to talk about suicide right now. There's enough deaths going on. People are frightened. Let's lean into what's worrying them. So that the rising tide that lifts all ships, this was a rising tide of anxiety that lifted everybody. And we did anecdotally find that for some people it wasn't as terrible as you might think. But as that tide rose, people who have always been fine in between their ears suddenly found themselves, you know, if you're going to get into a fight over a jar of peppers in Lidl,
yeah
it's the zombie apocalypse. And you start, I mean, I've got, as we talked about, I've got two kids, and you do start to think, what the hell's going to happen here? But the suicide rate didn't rise, and one of the things we had to really get at was the misinformation that was flying around everywhere of suicide rates have doubled, and a lot of it being anti-lockdown, anti-vaccine sort of propaganda, and that wasn't the case. Suicide remained about the same, actually with a slight dip, but a very almost a rounding error type.
Was that the same for suicidality, or were there more calls? Were there more people who were struggling with, again, isolation, desperation, finances, but not necessarily going to suicide?
Yeah, you're absolutely spot on. So the use of our helpline has grown 90% since then, or since the start of lockdown. So pre-lockdown, post-lockdown, and we continue to be up there.
Yeah.
90% increase. So yes, suicide didn't grow, but the overwhelming sense of fear, of anxiety, of the thousand things that people call us about was driven dramatically up.
And as you say, misery, which a lot of people were feeling. I think culturally there was a whole, everyone was going through in one way, shape or form some kind of miserable experience in their lives, whether people with, you know, money, and people with, you know, lots of children or whatever it might be. Everyone's experiences are very different, but everyone struggled in one way, shape or form at some stage in that process, I think everyone would probably say. And that's where the helpline, not just being about suicide, but about supporting people in their lives, really comes into its own. Do you have any sort of, you know, stories or moments from lockdown that really stick in your mind as to being, I guess, defining about why you do what you do, or why Calm is there?
The helpline definitely 90% increase, but our digital product. So we have to find ways to help people out away from a human helpline. A human helpline is a very effective thing for people that want it, completely ineffective for people that don't want to talk to a human. And we find that most people probably don't. Most people probably want to consume digital tools of some form, whether that's content, whether that's actual tools. We found that the use of our website, so the most tangible measurement, total engagement metrics, just went bam in 16 to 24 year olds. That really demonstrated, A, that we need to modernize, always retaining the helpline because it's so powerful, but modernize tools for people that don't want to interact with us in that way. Calm, I think, is deeply valued and loved by lots and lots and lots of people, even more now that it's become something which has to grow. I would be failing if we didn't continue to look at doubling our reach, doubling the use of our services, and innovating in ways that we can plug into your creator community. We can give all of you tools so that you're doing our work. We talk about, we lead a movement, we can't do it. There's 60 of us in Waterloo, and then there's like 100 people on the pool for the helpline with 26 people working at any time. But we lead that movement, and to equip people everywhere to help lead that movement against suicide is what we need to do.
Some of the things that government is getting wrong, and what are the things that they can be doing better?
They talk a lot about caring about suicide, and they just don't. They just don't. They do as individuals, don't get me wrong, they do, but there are very different priorities that mean that actually that's completely gone off the agenda. So that's obvious, and it's very clear, and it's very easy to solve because it's actually very small amounts of money. The problem, which is ignored, is that every suicide costs £1.68 million, so that's just shy of £15 billion a year that you and I, taxpayers, and all of your audience are spending. That's the cost of suicide deaths, right? So that's 15 billion.
How does that break down?
That's Public Health England number. That comes from blue light emergency services, lack of tax, lost work, all those kind of things. That's their number is 1.68 million per suicide. So that's relatively easy to solve. And what I'm really hoping is that current opposition are going to see that especially for younger audiences, these are very important subjects, and that really supporting suicide prevention is going to be a vote winner. That's what I hope, and that's what we're trying to encourage them to do. So that's easy. The stuff that's harder, and the stuff that we all know, if we were to pause and think about it, is that poor mental health, often suicide, living miserably is often related to earlier life trauma or current trauma, often related to addiction, homelessness, growing up in care, growing up without role models, all the stuff that we know that if we're going to put life in reverse, you know, you can just see it. Yeah. You can see where it starts. And to address endemic issues is something that no government really has the time or energy to do. And I do. I think we do that. Those kind of things culturally. Mm. I think that's what we have to do. When you're talking to the people that listen to you, and when all of the creators that listen to them and watch this, we have to solve these things at root, because government isn't going to do it. We'll keep pushing, and I'm optimistic. I am. I'm optimistic that we all expect to be the next government will have a different attitude. But this is a cultural issue, and we've got to solve it ourselves.
I think your point around bringing it to the, I guess, the local level, taking power into our own hands, so to speak, is really powerful and important. What can, you know, myself as a parent, right, I've got a 3.5-year-old and a 2-year-old and another one coming in December. Wow. What can we be doing as parents? What can teachers be doing? What can people in sort of tangible roles in society who really have the biggest impact at a small level, I believe, right? Everything starts in the family, everything starts at a local level. What can people do to take that power into our own hands?
I think it's really important that CALM comes back to what we really exist to, which is suicide prevention. And often it's tempting not to do that, because as we talked about earlier, you don't want to talk about it. It's horrible. But talking about it prevents it. So I want us to, in the next 5, maybe it has to be 10, maybe it has to be 15 years, to change our culture. So think about 30 years ago, LGBT rights were not discussed. Homosexuality was portrayed as hilarious and camp on Saturday night TV. It was a sniggering sort of secret, but out in the open, and, you know, all of the, it was just very, very awful. Now, I think everybody, all right-minded people, of course we talk about LGBT rights, of course we do, and of course we expect that to be a part of our society, but it wasn't, and it's organisations like Stonewall that have got us to there. Talking about suicide and having the ease to confront that issue on that level, on the same level that we've managed to achieve there, is miles and miles and miles away. I don't want to talk about it, and it's my job to talk about it. We've got to change. So when we talk to our kids, when we're talking to our audiences, whether you're a teacher or you're an influencer or whatever you are, we've got to start that process so that in 10 years' time, your kids are in a society where it's absolutely normal to confront something which is absolutely normal.
And as you say, your whole role as CALM is to destigmatize these issues. And I guess that's the role that we all have to play in our own homes, in our own families, in our own schools, to make the conversation not so sensationalized that it feels alien, but realize that it actually affects so many. I mean, I even know on a personal level, you know, how many people in my generation, how many suicides there are, how many people who are depressed, who are miserable. You know, I even think about the drug addictions, the alcoholism, all these things which will lead to that suicidality that culturally is so pervasive right now. I mean, I was thinking the other day, I mean, like, go back to, you think about people you know at school and you don't speak to them for a while, and then you hear, oh yeah, this person's commit suicide. Yeah. So is this person. Oh, and then this person in this school. And I think a lot of that in our generation anyway, maybe you wonder, with more openness about some of these issues, with more discourse, would those outcomes have been the same?
They wouldn't. Yeah, I mean, I can't say definitively, but what we shouldn't do is deny ourselves the opportunity to find out. because of shame, because of stigma, because of long-held cultural mores, which I didn't sign up for, you haven't signed up for. They were just passed to us from, you know, the baton was passed to us and we didn't ask for it. And we have the tangible means to change that. Once we've changed that, and once we confront, we can confront addiction, for example, in different ways. I'm fascinated by the world of psychedelic medicine, which is another area of knowledge which we deny ourselves. We deny ourselves because of the Reagan administration in the US 30 years ago with the war on drugs, you know, and we mustn't deny ourselves opportunities to help the people around us and help ourselves, because, well, I'll tell you one thing as well, which I was quite besotted by when I first learned about it. Back to that pack animal that we, the nature that we have, the tribal nature that we have, we get, and you know it, I know it, we get the drops of the good stuff when we help the people around us. It's a part of what cements us in our tribes and our pack. So we mustn't deny ourselves those helping techniques, those really simple tools, asking people how they are, asking them again, being sincere about it. And then as we move, we can start to change the cultural approach to suicide and solve those issues too.
So the Sidemen and Calm, I think, you know, the last charity match was amazing. It was incredible to see the impact. I remember hearing and seeing some of the numbers and the stats. What's your view on the Sidemen, on the charity match? What did it mean to Calm to be involved? Like, and what was the tangible impact that game last year had? And hopefully this year can have an even bigger one.
I mean, at the risk of being a bit vulgar, the money is really, really useful. It costs £8 for us to take a call on our helpline. And so that's kind of the tangible output that we can measure. So that support, I am being totally sincere. Yeah, it's just fantastic. It's just brilliant.
What was the number? Do you remember the number off the top of your head? I can't remember what it was, but how many calls?
It was about 52,000 calls that were paid for directly by the match. You got our brand in front of millions and millions of people that otherwise wouldn't have seen it. What we can do again this time is we can really start to deliver the messaging, and also the delivering some of our tools to the audience so that they can start coming into our movement as well. Mm. And then the ambition for us is when you wear the badge, you wear it your whole life. And so you might be 15 now, and you start wearing the Calm badge, and then you have kids, and then those kids get older and they take the badge. Mm. And we want that identification with our cultural positioning to be something which is solid and lasts a really long time. And we can't do that. We don't have media budgets. Mm. We just don't have them. We are, however, the most awarded advertiser in the world in 2023. Well, I get that in summer. But we don't have any budget. We it's all pro bono, everything. Mm. The brilliant partners that we have, whether that's advertising agencies or media companies or, you know, brands like BMW and Beavertown and all those kind of people, and you take us, we ride on your back. But when you deliver those tools and those messages to your audience, they know it came from you. And we form strong bonds between all of our groups.
So look, to wrap this up, because I think it's been amazing, and thank you so much for sharing everything. I think one question that I would have for you is, for young entrepreneurs today, whether they're content creators or whether they're aspiring startup founders, whatever it might be, what would be your big advice to somebody who has to deal with suicide and mental health day in, day out? What would be your big piece of advice to them if they may be struggling?
Seek help. Formal medical healthcare is really, really good. Doctors are really clever, and your GP will help you. Just go and talk to someone. What's the worst that can happen? If that is for you, also do other stuff. If it isn't for you, do the other stuff. Go to our website, read all the stuff, watch all the videos, do all the interactive things that you can do. But put your hand up as well. It's like jumping into a cold swimming pool. It's really, really awful for the first little bit. And then you kind of find, you know, I'm getting used to this now. This is actually all right. And just asking somebody to help you does everybody all the good. All the good stuff starts to drip about your brain, and it drips about your friend's brain, your loved one's brain as well, and people want to come together and look after each other. So it's not a matter of confronting shame, although it is. It's not a matter of getting over things which society finds hard to do, although they do. It's a matter of your own self-determination, your own conviction in the future being potentially better than the present, that it can be, and that it won't do any harm to try to find out.
Good place to end. Simon, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
I think for anybody listening to that, hopefully they got, as I did, a real sense of the epidemic that is suicide, and that is mental health and well-being in this time, but also how practically and tangibly we can start to make change to support people out there. I think for aspiring entrepreneurs and people who are working in business, and also for content creators, people with an audience, you know, the responsibility that we have to look after people and to make tangible steps to support our culture in tackling this issue head on is so important. And that's why, look, we're so privileged and proud to be supporting Calm this year at the charity match. The impact of raising the conversation and the awareness around suicide is what prevents it. There's so much from him that I'm going to be taking into our business, into my own mindset around specifically this topic, but also the issue of general well-being and mental health and looking after people. It's so important that we are there for our colleagues, we're there for our employees, we're there for our co-founders. Thank you so much to Simon for coming on this episode of Unboxed. Make sure to like, subscribe and follow us. We'll be back for another episode of Unboxed next week.